In a time where social justice organizations are under attack, we bring you Rad Ops. That stands for Radical Operations. It's a dialogue-based tool that supports organizations assessing and discussing the possibilities and limitations of putting liberatory values into practice.
Many organizations are in turmoil as they pivot to meet this moment. RadOps offers principles, guiding questions, and tools that organizations can use to identify ways that they can and cannot practice liberatory values in this unjust world.
I'm one of your co-hosts, Yeshna Maya Padamsi.
And I'm your other co-host, Sha Grogan Brown. Together, we bring over 40 years of movement operations experience to inform these conversations. Our topic for this episode is the life cycle of organizations. Before we introduce our guest, we want to name that in this episode, we're going to get into some real talk about the viability of our movement organizations in these times. If you listened to the trailer of this podcast, you heard us mention how the role and special skills of movement operations leaders spans the entire life cycle of organizations. We might be most recognized for building and maintaining organizations, but we also play key roles in pivoting the activities or even the mission and core purpose of our organizations when conditions shift. We sometimes close or sunset existing organizations, and we also birth new organizations. So with the state of the world and the rise of authoritarianism, we know that our movement organizations are facing some deeply challenging situations on many fronts. And some of these really tough questions we think that many organizations need to be asking are these. How does the purpose of our organization need to pivot under these conditions? Is this organization we've built in previous conditions still the one that is needed in this current moment? And I've had to try saying this a few times now because it brings me a lot of heartbreak. But this last question is our focus still on organizations when many of them may not make it through this period? Whew, that is tough to say. When we decided to cover this topic as the closing episode of the season, we were really clear that we wanted to talk with Raquel Lavinia about this. Raquel is a longtime organizer and was pushed literally into activism when she attempted to get services from Planned Parenthood as a teenager. She went on to help develop the form of youth organizing we know today before spending a decade in the domestic workers movement at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, amplifying the value of all work and dignity of all workers. Most recently, she's played a key role in collaboration with the Working Families Party and Grassroots Power Project. As a healer, she's integrated personal transformation practices into power building work, knowing that we can show up as better leaders, comrades, and strategists when we're not taking action from trauma, but from center.
Welcome, Raquel. We're so happy to have you.
Only you two could get me on video.
We're honored about that.
We're really, really, really looking forward to talking with you about this juicy topic on this life cycle of organizations, partially because of your deep and broad experience working with so many groups in various states of startup, pivots, sunsets, organizational culture shifts. You have offered so much to our movement, and we have both learned so much working with you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm already feeling both the highs and lows of, you know, the potential heartbreaks or the heartbreaks we've all been through, but also like the potential beauty that comes from that. And like in this 3 minutes of recording, we've already felt that.
Yes. Thank you for naming that. And I think that's one reason I've loved working with you is that you are both deeply grounded in what is the real deal of like how we need to move at a mass scale, but also can slow down enough to like feel for the heart of it all. And I just love that you have modeled that for me. And I've been lucky enough to call you teacher, mentor, comrade, compañera, supervisor, and friend. Not everybody makes it through a supervisor relationship, We've made it through and beyond.
Not everybody makes it through to friend.
That's true. I'm lucky. And I've always admired how you can read a room and help move the collective to our deeper collective purpose. I loved working and training side by side with you at Generative Somatics and at NDWA, learning so much from you during many late nights of infrastructure building, event planning, and general problem solving. So just wanted to name some of our history, a sliver of it, and really grateful again that you're here. Shaw, how do you know Raquel?
Well, I mean, I had known of the legacy of Raquel for a long time, even like since the 2000s. But my earliest memory of working together and beginning to learn more directly from you was when I was moving into a deputy director position at Grassroots Global Justice in the late 2010s. And you were really generous in offering me some guidance and sort of thinking about the approach that you had developed in that role and the learnings that you had. And then you also ended up supporting me and others to move through some organizational culture shifts with somatic and transformative and relational approaches. And I learned through that you like really know how to read people. And I have been read by you multiple times with consent. But you really have a pulse on like this skill to really kind of see and read sort of here's what I think is going on under the surface. And I've really been blessed to learn that from you, and lately been working on a writing project with you, which also gave us the space to have some real juicy conversations. So I know we're going to have a good conversation today.
And I mean, I'll just say that I said yes to the both of you, but partly because of what you just described. Like, what I trust is that we can have very hard conversations. We can talk about, you know, beautiful visions for the future and how close we are or are not to them. We can get through really difficult moments and learn from each other. So, I mean, if people do know me, you know that I do not like being on video. You know, I do not like being on camera or taking pictures even. So it's that you two, I trust this relationship because we've been through the hardest times and that made the relationship stronger, which I think is something that we all need to rely on, that things that are often the most uncomfortable result in the strongest relationships.
Yeah, I feel like it's a personal life achievement.
Yes, walking side by side with Raquel is a personal life achievement and has been, and I think what you just said, Raquel, has been such a consistent refrain through this podcast and through this project in general, is like it always comes back to relationship and building through the fire and keeping relationship at the center. Yeah.
Yeah. And with like, you know, this question that we do keep asking ourselves, you know, how can our relationships outlast the current structures that we're in? So we're excited to get into that with you. Before we go into sort of, we have a lot of detailed questions, but in the spirit of the like no one size fits all, we want to offer you a chance to just give us a like read. We know you're good at it. More on the political landscape, you know, and any sort of big lessons learned or assessments that you're making in this time around the state of our organizations that you think are kind of fundamental big picture before we tackle the zoomed in things, or that you might want to refer back to during our conversation.
I mean, I think the biggest thing, even that we've seen over the last few months, and in particular in Minnesota, I'm in LA, we saw this when I first came here, is that our ability to build power might be limited by, you know, increased repression, rising authoritarianism. But actually what's going to happen is that there's going to be millions of people who are wanting to get involved, who are going to be unhappy with how things are going. And they're going to take action, whether we know them or not, whether they're connected to our organizations or not, and they're putting their lives on the line. So if our organizations can't get past the sort of infighting or the internal focus, or, you know, competing with each other for limited resources or terrain and all of that, if we can't personally like deal with the differences that people are going to come in with, like if millions of people are going to come in with, they are not going to know our politics. We are going to have to work with them. So if we can't get all over that, then we are not going to be able to lead a broad front against authoritarianism, no matter how hard we try. So I'm invested in our organizations being able to organize in the millions. And that will mean, you know, preserving a lot of what RadOps was founded on. You know, I know that you and all the founders put this together because infrastructure was often considered like back of the house or ignored or undervalued, right? And you wanted to be able to right size it because it worked to me. How I've always thought about it is that operations is like this diving board. And so if it's like bouncy and resilient and flexible, but also strong, then like the organizing can soar, right? And so it's that. There's a real integrated relationship between powerful infrastructure and powerful organizing. And what has also happened in the last few years is that, you know, our organizations have gotten more resources. So like our salaries have gotten higher, our working conditions are getting better, which is great, but our bases have not grown. Our organizing hasn't necessarily expanded. And, you know, with all the organizations, you know, who knows how many are going to make it through this period. That kind of like internal looking, if we can't figure out how to like organize in the millions and take care of our people, I don't know how we're going to make it. So for me, this coming onto this podcast is thinking about exactly what you intro'd us with, how do operations people, knowing that we are essential to helping strategy go, use the qualities that we've learned of starting, stewarding, sunsetting, pivoting in our movement building, even if our organizations don't make it.
Whew. Taking that in, Raquel.
Sorry, that was like bad news, but I delivered it with a smile.
But I feel like the thing you named about the flexibility really stood out to me too, the diving board, you know, that I do think that's something we've seen so many operations people have to have that skill in whatever moment, and especially in a moment like this where things are shifting and we've got to be nimble. So that really stood out to me.
Yeah. And bad news, yes, but I also think clarity is not bad news. So if we have this clarity that we're in this pivotal moment where we need to make some hard decisions, that's actually good news. So right out the gate, speaking the truth and appreciating the clarity. So now that we've done a little like present moment analysis, I actually want to lean back a little bit and talk about, as you know, we're building out a RadOps lineage timeline. And I want to note here that when I think about my lineage, I definitely name you as a mentor in my lineage, and I'm honored to walk this path that you've helped lay. So just wanted to name that you're part of this lineage. But we're asking all of our guests, is there some person, organization, movement lineage that you want to name and honor? And in that, tell us about yourself. Like, how have you been shaped through these lineages? And tell us what type of RadOps roles you've played and what's your personal ops route?
This was a difficult question to narrow down. But when I thought about it, it really came down to, I think I've shaped and been shaped by three generations of organizing. So when I first came in, the elders who trained me were from the 60s and 70s, the New Left revolutionaries, and third wave feminists. So, you know, they were leading organizations at a time where they were embedded in the community and supported by the community. So they, you know, they weren't getting salaries from a nonprofit, but they were, you know, living together in one house and one person could work and everybody else could organize. So for probably the first 12 years of being an organizer, I bartended at night and organized for free during the day. And so that's how I was brought up, that, you know, your organizing was embedded in your life and it was your commitment and duty to change that drove you. And it wasn't necessarily your job, your paid work. And then I led in another era when some of those elders, you know, stood back and were disillusioned by the movement and the times, right? So this is 90s. And so, you know, many of us who had just been recently trained were trying to lead. And what we tried to do then was create a new model of organizing that took the sort of systematic nature of Alinsky style organizing, the kind of political education and respect for ideology from the new left, and the kind of mobilizing of mass movements that happened during the 60s and the 70s and in the 80s. And try to integrate all these together to develop a new model. And so for me, I applied that mostly to youth organizing, like queer youth in New York City for, you know, public space, or decreasing the number of juvenile detention beds in California. And then I moved to, you know, winning fair employment standards for nannies and house cleaners and home care workers. So in terms of my ops role, I probably spent the last decade on what people would call internal, but the reason that I did that is two reasons. One, I felt like in our organizing, we were always making campaign demands based on like the world we wanted, as opposed to what power we actually had to win. And then we would have these teams of like staff and members who could not possibly win those demands, nor were they supported. So I pivoted to internal because I thought, if we can really prepare our people to win anything, I wanted to enter in the internal from the perspective of a campaigner, and break down that those two things are either different from each other or oppositional. I thought all of our organizations would be stronger if they were integrated. At the same time, you know, I had gone through a lot of healing myself from, you know, history of sexual violence, had run a domestic violence shelter, and was really just brought in by organizations like Kindred or Generative Somatics to like focus on healing. And those methodologies were kind of separate from our organizing. And I really have worked for 30 years to say, like, instead of ignoring or just allowing the kind of trauma to determine our relationships with each other, what if we paid attention to healing and transformation and wove that into our building power and our infrastructure and our policies? Could that actually create a more powerful organization from which to win?
There was so much there, and I'm so grateful for it all. But I think where you started us, it feels also really important context for this conversation of, okay, if we're not sure where we're going as a left movement, and if these organizations are the structures that are going to take us there. Oh, actually, no, I want to clarify that we know where we're going. We know where we want to go. Anti-authoritarianism, you know, as key. And but if we know where we're going to go, but we don't know if these organizations are the vehicles to get us there, mm-hmm. we can look back and be like, how did we get to this point? How did our elders and our, you know, the past generations handle a moment like this? So I'm really glad you started us there, because I feel like that's so essential. And also just hearing about your path and how many different roles you've played, and bringing all of that into operations and in quote unquote internal. But also in that you broke down the false binaries that we talk about in this project of like, it's not operations and programs. It's actually, we want to move as a unit and learn from all the different skills that we're all bringing. That's what I heard in that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also was, it was making me think about a skill that you have, Raquel, that's like pushing people to be visionary from whatever place they are, and to, for each of us to really own our power and own our ability to change things or influence things, and like not just implement, but implement with a vision and be part of that strategizing. I've really seen you do that with me, with me, myself, and also with others around us. And then I think the other thing I'm thinking about as I was listening to you describe, you know, all this work that has informed your work is how you've really iterated upon it over time, and yes. how so often you can like reference, okay, this is where this thing came from, this framework or this activity. Now, here's my spin on it, what I think this particular group needs in this moment. And I think that's another skill that is, you know, under-recognized and that's really another like operations skill that's kind of drawing from like what came before and what has, where did it get us? And now that we're here, where do we go with it next? And, you know, I think especially with articulating these principles, we're going to get into our RadOps principles, but you were one of the people that informed these principles as we were kind of honing them through this process. And so we also wanted to ask you to, you know, lift up a principle that resonates for you or that's been sort of a guiding force for you in your approach to this work and, you know, ways that you've seen folks putting it into practice.
They all resonate with me. And that's one of the things that I really appreciate about the RadOps approach, that you're not just saying, let's have good operations, but it has to be operations that's grounded in our strategy and in our vision. And that means that all of us have to really step up and get strategic, you know, understand the vision and not just say, oh, we're in operations, we don't have to do that. As much as we don't want program people to be like, why isn't somebody coordinating my thing? No, I do not have time to submit my receipts. I was like, if you don't submit your receipts, we can't get them, you know, all of that. So I do think the one that I think I feel the most proud of that helped like really show the integration for me is investing in transformation of people and systems. And so I think I'm going to share one of my favorite things I've ever had to do. When I started at NDWA, I helped develop the SOL program, which was strategy, organizing, and leadership. And this was
2011, I think we started.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And Yashna was helping with the operations of that and eventually became a teacher because we were all like, you have to keep growing. And she wanted to grow, but you have to keep growing your skill, right? And breaking down the binary. But, you know, this was at a time where the Alliance was smaller and we grew doubled in size and complexity like every year in that period. And I think one of the reasons why we were able to do that was because of the investment in leadership development and that leadership development asked the women to come in and learn on multiple fronts. So what's the history of domestic work and its legacy in slavery? What does that mean for our strategic interventions today? What's the organizing as a main strategy? But that also includes being able to run an organization, right? Because that's like the building block. We needed domestic worker organizations in every corner of the country in order to organize a 2.5 million domestic workers in the country if we were only like numbered in the thousands, right? So you needed organizing strategy and the ability to run infrastructure. And then your personal transformation, all of us recognize that we had trauma, not just from our histories in life, but being in a workplace where we were often treated like less than human, right? And so the domestic workers are tasked with like intimately caring for their employers, like bodies, children's homes, yet we're not given that same kind of intimate respect back. And so those are really hard conditions from which to become a powerful leader. So in that program, we helped design, I think the first year was like 100 and something women. And, you know, so every year it kind of grew and we would be in multiple day, multiple retreats over the course of the year and, you know, really leaned into how can we help each other through our own transformation. And it wasn't that we said, you know, this is going to be healing. This is going to heal you entirely. But the healing that you get here opens up more space in you to become a better leader. And for me, my favorite, you know, thing about it is that we took a picture of the whole class at the beginning and at the end, and everybody grew an inch. They were like, wow, so dignified and so much more wide. And so like, they were just bigger, filling up the space. And one of the many things is like, you know, our repression makes us small, and that will affect how we think about what we can win and how small our organizations are going to be. So let us be in our full dignity and our full width, take up space, you know, rely on the history of domestic workers before us and move forward into a vision to build these strong organizations and build dignity for all work and win fair employment standards. And so you could really see how the political education, the organizing strategy, the infrastructure and transformation integrated in any one person, so much so that they grew an inch. The entire class was not taller, including all of us.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so powerful. I'm just imagining that photos, that those like side-by-side photos. And I was even feeling myself like, oh yeah, we can get bigger while you were talking about that. And just the link that you're making between people transforming and growing and taking up space with also then the work that we do in the world growing and taking up space or shrinking, depending on how we're figuring out our place and how we're leading.
Yeah. And it was also one of the my favorite things that I've ever done. So I love hearing that from you too, Raquel. And I think as I was doing the logistics and event planning for all of the soul retreats, I think one thing I really felt from you, Raquel, was that the infrastructure building around this particular program was as essential to the work that we were doing, because of when you get down to the purpose of it, like we are creating a space to care for the caregivers. What you were saying, they're not getting dignity and respect in their own workplaces. Here is a chance to do a wraparound way of expressing care, dignity, and respect, not just in the programming, but also in the infrastructure and how we feed them and how we provide childcare and how we provide interpretation in the comfort of the beds they're sleeping on. That each element of the infrastructure we were building around this program was essential to how the program's success was, for them to be able to like be fully present in their, whether it's their healing, their transformation, their leadership development, they needed that piece to it.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, this is not the replacement for strategy or taking action, but we can show up better to develop strategy and take up action if we are really thinking about how we care for people and what the infrastructure is. And I feel like, you know, 10 years later in 2020, we had one of our biggest assemblies. And so it was like 1,500 people at that time came in. And I remember we were like in a huge hotel in Las Vegas. We had built out this entire stage that was about the dignity of workers. And I remember some of the women who came in who were in that original first program walked in, and they just like several of them just fell to their knees, started crying. And they were like, I imagined how big we were 10 years ago. And now I'm seeing it. I'm seeing it in this room. I walked into this room and I understand we are big. And it was like, that's what we're doing. You know, when you can actually manifest, you know, you can see in real time what we are trying to go towards, knowing we are not there yet, but because we have paid attention to history and strategy and our personal transformation, we are more likely to be able to get there together.
What a beautiful story. I love that.
And, you know, it's making me think about like two things. One is just, I think the work that y'all were doing at that time, I wasn't directly involved, but I was learning about it as a peer, and it had ripple effects. in a lot of organizations. And I remember, like, in my conversations, my phone a friend conversations with Yashna during that time, it was sort of like, you know, this is the approach we're taking in the moments when we're together. How can we meet as many needs as possible for people to be in their full dignity and be fully in the strategy conversation, everyone? And, you know, I know that it had ripple effects in Grassroots Global Justice and a lot of our member organizations, a lot of other organizations. So just not only for the membership, but actually in our movement. And then the other thing it's making me think of is I do think there's like a discernment we have to be making in like, when are we needing that level of meeting that level of needs? Because it's one thing to be creating a space for a limited amount of time for a strategic purpose for like a week or a couple of days, and then to be an employer that's all the time navigating what needs can we meet as an organization. And I think there's something juicy there that we could probably get into, but just that I think there's like a, you know, some of the ways that we bump up against being able to be fully liberatory all the time we've been talking about in this project is like, we can do a maximum level at certain moments in certain conditions, but then it's also hard that we can't usually translate that to like the regular time of our days, because we're still in capitalism and we're still in rising fascism and we still have constraints that we can't get past. So there's something there too for me that was just sparking when you were describing that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Just the refrain of we can't always do everything, and so how to be in discernment. And I think this kind of relates to the next question for you, Raquel, which is if you had to name an operations topic of conversation that gets the most airtime in the work you're doing with organizations right now, what would it be? Like, what are you hearing on the ground in organizations? What are the live questions that ops folks are in right now?
Good thing you just talked about the live question.
Teed that one up for you.
I often am like, yeah, I am one of the people that helped amplify the need for sustainability and well-being and like integrating of operations and strategy and organizations. And sorry.
Me too. Same.
My bad. But that's how learning works, right? You're like, I notice a huge contradiction that I want to solve. And in this case, let's solve it by trying to make more understood the relationship between infrastructure and strategy and well-being and our work. And honestly, I was trained by people who were like, the organization is the only thing that matters. The movement is the only thing that matters. And you as an individual do not, right? And so we're trying, I feel like we have been trying, and RadOps is really important to that, to solve that contradiction. And then you go too far the other way. You know, where then I think some organizations, and this is when I have worked with organizations, conflate well-being to feeling comfortable all the time. Or it's very hard then once you start to open up the idea of well-being or healing in an organization for particularly the leadership to have clean and clear boundaries about what an organization can provide or support. And so I think we're just in a place where we have to like right size that. And unfortunately, we're having to do it when many of our organizations might not make it. And we're having to do it when actually looking internal is good so that people feel supported as they're doing the external work, but the external pressures and dangers are so much higher than they were even 5 years ago. So I think we're going to have to learn how to like right size well-being and like strategic impact faster. You know, we may have had the luxury of like, let's go all the way to this side for like a few years before we like kind of scale it back and people are able to get more clear and people understand like well-being does not mean I'm comfortable. Liberatory values in my infrastructure does not mean that I feel free all the time. You know, I think we could have had some time to get to the right size, but we're not right now. So a lot of what I'm working on now is actually getting to the place where people feel supported inside their organizations in order to make the strategic impact that we need to make. That one has to go faster. Two, that's the responsibility of everybody. That is not the responsibility of just the people who have positions that are, you know, senior positions in an organization or the title of director and above. I think it's really important to understand the power of both, you know, positional leadership and influential leadership. People who don't have the titles can really easily set the morale and the tone for the entire organization. So if we have to be right-sized about how comfortable or how supported we feel internally so that we can make our external impact, everybody's responsible for setting that tone. That is, you know, not just the responsibility of the leadership. And, you know, honestly, and you've both seen this from me, I both as a leader am openly, willingly own my mistakes. And I think a lot of leaders feel a lot of pressure right now. I get it. And we also have to make adjustments. Many of us came up into leadership and were responsible for the entire thing, filled every single gap, and then found it hard to give up the level of control that you feel when you get to, like, you know, yeah, you're overworked, but you also are like, but then I'm getting to determine everything. And so, you know, it's both for the people who are like staff and member leaders to help establish the kind of tone and morale of the entire organization. And it's for senior leadership to step back, allow others to take over control and decision-making and allow those mistakes to happen so that we can all learn. So a lot of what I'm doing right now is how can we make people feel comfortable, be clear about when and how we can support. And all of us are like eyes on the prize around stopping authoritarianism. Like that's what we're supposed to do. And that's what I'm talking about a lot.
That's so good. There's so much there. I really resonate with you of being like, I was one of the people who really pushed wellness and sustainability and, you know, in our organizations, and now am like stepping back to be like, did I push us too far? And how do we balance out again? And I think we're being called. I hope other folks are hearing the call to balance out as well. And yeah, I like what you said about figuring out what can the organization support staff on and what they can't. And then everyone just having to be okay with that. Like, we can't do it all. Our organizations aren't the place to get everything because there's a larger strategic purpose. And how do we get enough support to be able to move that purpose? But
yeah, and I think you said this before too, that can really be a setup for anyone in an organization to have that, the level of expectation that our organizations will be able to meet the needs and the gaps that are left with all of our like unfunded state infrastructure, corporatized care systems. Like, it's too big of a gap for us. So there's like, you know, we also want to offer some like, hey, it's okay. We cannot actually do it all. And the more we can get clear, you know, about like, here's what we can and here's what we can't. And then, you know, I've talked with both of you about like the heartbreak that we just have to be able to let ourselves feel, which is a deep struggle I am currently still in, like letting myself feel heartbroken about that and still staying in, you know.
And I mean, we have a limited amount of resources, right? And so I think sometimes, you know, when anybody in the organization makes a decision that doesn't seem like it goes along with our values, like that's usually not because they're not committed to liberation. It's usually because we have to make decisions about finite resources. And, you know, I'm coming from the perspective of everything we do has to result in a larger base of people that my organization can absorb so that we're both stopping authoritarianism, but then also forwarding our like visionary goals. Then that's what I'm making decisions based on. And I think, you know, when we're in the day to day, it doesn't always feel like that. It feels like somebody's like, we're in a power struggle, or, you know, or you're letting down, you know, because you now get paid higher, you don't have the same values as me, or, you know, you, because you've learned how to be a great organizer, are now organizing against me as your ED, because I'm closer to you than the man is, you know what I mean? And it's like, so like, just take all of that away. And like, the goal is that our bases have to get bigger and we have to have a more powerful impact externally. And then from there, if that's the main thing, how much support can we give each other internally? Some of that is going to be financially and like in your employment standards, but a lot of that is going to be in our quality of relationships with each other. And those relationships are the things that are going to outlast any organizational infrastructure.
Well, and that's a good segue to talk about this piece that we're writing. Although, Yeshna, were you going to say something?
Just what we've said before, but I do think it bears repeating that RadOps isn't about 100% values aligned infrastructure. It's not going to be that. It's never going to be that. We can't achieve that. But we want people to talk to each other to figure out what are the values that we have, how can we get close enough to those to be able to create a buoyant infrastructure that you're talking about, that diving board that's supportive and strong enough, but has that flexibility to launch the work. And so, yeah, just to repeat that it's never going to be 100%, but it's about getting enough. That's the radical part, is like getting enough of the values met to be able to forward the work.
Yeah. And I think it's also radical to then say, here's how far we can get right now. It's at 60%. That's great. Go us. That's as far as we can go right now. And, you know,
because that's in alignment with the world building that we're dreaming up. Is like, it's not going to happen overnight. We know revolution takes time. And so let's get to the 30%, 40%, 60% and learn what those building blocks are.
Well, and I, you know, the biggest conversation that I'm having inside of organizations, in addition to that, like, struggle over what is well-being versus impact, it's related, but pace, right? And so there's a huge conversation about pace, because many times, you know, the people who are making decisions about pace are like, well, we have to add this, or this feels urgent, or we need to do this. Or if you're like, you're with members who are going through crisis, and it's like, we have to respond to this, we have to help with this, like, you know, there's always more that can be done. And the discernment about what's our lane, what do we have the power to do, what do we have the capacity to do, is a really hard, it's a much harder conversation than saying yes to everything on the front end and then scrambling through and fighting with each other throughout and on the other end and like creating these resentments. And so I have come into organizations where the pace conversation is about, we just need to go slower or do less. And what I have learned is that it's not slower or less, it's the intention to every part of the work that you're doing. So you may not do less, but you might have to spend more time on the front end saying, what is this project? What do we have the capacity to do? Are you in agreement? Can we negotiate right now? Instead of like just jumping because of urgency into something. And even rapid response, you could have some more intentional conversation on the front end of like, we're going to do this rapid response and we're not going to do this for a minute. But I think that pace is really like how much time quickly, but with depth, you spend on the front end, making sure people are on as much of the same page as you can. Mm-hmm. Continue to talk through the implementation and then really, really evaluate on the other end so that you know, actually, we did this really well. We didn't do before jumping into the next thing. So you can bring those lessons forward. And my thing is like the pace of what we've done is just jump into the implementation and then allow all the relationships to like fall apart. You go right into the next thing. And so whatever resentment was built up during the implementation just gets carried forward. And I just think the pace is, let us be in every stage of taking action together so the pace isn't like, it's not a black and white, we need to do things slower or we need to do less things. It's like, it's intentional. Intentional. Everybody's pace might be different. There's no one right way.
I love what you said. It's not about slowing down, but it's about being intentional. And just wanted to lift up how intentional infrastructure building within our organizations and movements lends itself so clearly to relationality and relationship building, that especially where operations folks are positioned. I know when I was events director at NDWA, I had to talk to so many people at the organization across program area, across operations, across leadership level, so many different people. And oftentimes I, in this ops role, had the bigger picture than other people in their very specific roles. And so there's just so much opportunity here for relationality, relationship building, when we're intentional about building our infrastructure, and when we're intentional about building our relationships. It actually really goes hand in hand together. So thank you for naming that.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question that you have asked other people, Raquel, because you know, I've been supporting you in writing this piece about building resilient movements and cultivating relational security. And, you know, you've been sharing, like articulating some practices that you've iterated over time, like I mentioned. So you asked a number of movement leaders this question, and I want to ask you this question now. How can resilient relationships be baked into the organizational structure so we're not relying on individual mastery or setback due to transitions?
I think that there's a lot of things. So hopefully people will read this piece that Sean and I have been working on. But I do think that why I originally wrote this, started writing this piece, was security is obviously on everybody's mind. And we were in this period, it's like a little bit past now, where people were just like, let's get compliant, let's figure out all of our digital stuff, let's, you know, make sure that all of the legal stuff is in place, and we should totally do that. What felt missing was, again, part of my training from the elders was, you know, the relationships that you have being clean, direct, clear, above board. Assume you're always being recorded, and so then every word you say is your integrity. Those kinds of relationships, building trustworthy relationships, is actually key to security, right? Because, you know, our digital operation, all of that, we can have those in place or not. Many of these organizations may not make it through all of that, but what will remain is the relationships. So that attention to relationships is really important. And you know, I do think this is the time where we're going to find out, like, who's in for building long-term movement and who's in because we got hired to do a job. And like, that's totally fine, right? But I think there will be, you know, some choices people will have to make along the way over the next few years. And what will remain is the relationships that we have with each other in order to continue building the world that we want. So how do you build practices into an organization is that you want to pay attention to those relationships from the beginning, right? Like Jovita and Wham wrote something about dealing with stuff when the resentments or the tensions are at a 1 or a 2 so that they don't get to a 10. You know, Chris Lamberto saying like, you know, you can't practice under pressure what you didn't practice when you weren't under pressure, you know, or Purvi Shah talking about like legal infrastructure isn't the thing that's going to save us. Like our organizing is going to save us, right? There are so many things that people said along the way that I thought were really useful. And in Tanya talking about, you know, if we're not in relationship with each other, people will use coping mechanisms that are in isolation and often not healthy, right? So let's call each other in so that we are able to do the work. I'll say for me, one of the practices that I'd like to share is one, and so if people went through generative somatics, you will recognize the basics of this one. So what Shah referred to earlier was, how can we take some of those practices and then really tailor them to our times? So this is CFIB, which is, you know, center the C. Always have to do that. Like, what's your commitment? What's your purpose? Why am I in this conversation or this relationship with you? Face F, because you have to face it. You know, not all things need to be faced, like not every tension needs to be faced, but we do have to face it to know which ones need to be dealt with. So face it. And that takes a lot of courage, but face it. E, enter. I'm entering into dialogue, negotiation, action with you. Let's enter. Extend. So extend to you. And I think a lot of times people want to trust who they're going to work with before they work together. And the only way we're going to trust is if we break it and know we can repair it. So I'm always like, extend trust from the beginning, knowing that my heart might get broken. And my heart has been resilient and strong enough to be repaired again. So it's okay, right? Not all levels of heartbreak are okay, but many of them are, right? And so let's extend trust and take action together. Blend. So I really know my commitment, why I'm in this conversation, why I'm in this relationship. But I actually really not need to blend with your perspective. Really see it from your place, not just like my interpretation or assumptions about you, but blend with a person on the other side. And then the iteration that I came up with Spenta Khandelwala and RJ McConney is lead. And this is really important in this moment, that once we go through these whole processes of like trying to work something out in an organization, we actually all have to lead to like, this is the issue. We have dealt with it. We are making amends. We have new agreements. And now I am going to close this. I am not going to carry this same story that I had about you, that I walked into this whatever conflict it was or courageous conversation. I'm not going to hold this against you in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 2 days out from here. It is now a clean slate because we've all agreed to put attention to it. We have put attention to it. And we're going to lead now because what's most important is building our bases, stopping authoritarianism, and having our external impact. And so I think that's like what I feel like today is that resilience, is that we are going to figure out, we're going to discern what issues actually need to be dealt with, go through the process of dealing with them. And once we've made agreements and amends, that is closed. We are all agreeing to keep moving forward and leading, because like what we have to do in the world is the important thing.
Yeah. And I guess the thing I would also throw in there for myself is that I think sometimes closure means accepting we disagree.
Absolutely. Mm.
And it's just, it doesn't mean we've wrapped it all up with a nice bow and everybody gets along and we all agree with everything. You know, it means like we have discerned what was important to handle here. We've worked it out. We're on the same page that we disagree. And now we're going to lead together in that, holding that disagreement and evaluating it as we go.
Absolutely. And I actually find that me, when I work with people that I don't agree with all the time, my work actually gets stronger. You know, so I'm like, it would not work if everybody was like me. We would only get one thing done.
I feel like I keep hearing you talk about like the clarification of and how I'm interpreting it is like two levels of the collective. Like one level is this organization or movement wide level, and this other level of the collective is the world we live in, our neighbors, the systems we're trying to change, and that we maybe are getting sometimes stuck in the organizational level of collective versus thinking about the broader collective. So this question is going to take us into this, like the organizational level of the collective. So, and it's a tough question that Shaw and I were like, Raquel is the one to ask. So thanks for being someone we can bring the tough questions to. So for orgs who are grappling with a purpose that may need to shift in this moment, and you've spoken to this through the podcast so far, do you have any advice that you can offer how we can be making the kind of assessments that will support these decisions of like, okay, we as an organization have met our goal, what now? Or we as an organization are not meeting it, what now? How do you make the assessment of an org that needs to shift?
Well, I mean, I think I just talked a lot about that. I mean, I think we've all talked a lot about that discernment and that, you know, we may come through processes and disagree. We also may discern different things need to be dealt with. And so for me, I'm somebody that really understands that every closing is an opening. And so it might be that you have to pivot. And I think the biggest thing is, are you having the external impact that you came together for? And, you know, if our salaries are growing, but our bases are smaller, then you're not having the impact. If you're like primarily thinking about the organization and not like what we're trying to do in the world, then you might need to shift. Did your organization like really need to come and be initiated at a time where somebody was not paying attention to your constituency and that really needed to amplify? And at this point, it's amplified, but the work is not progressing, right? Those are all reasons to think like, is it worth it to use the resource, take the resources that we have now and share them elsewhere to another part of the movement that might need it? And this is really about being self-aware as individuals, as organizations, and having a good assessment of the landscape in which we're organizing to say, maybe it's like my issue is most important to me. It may not be the most important thing to fight on right now. And I think that's a hard thing to say. I also think a lot of the organizations that are going through a lot of huge internal battles right now are, you know, this is when you have to think, are the resources that we have being used to solve these internal battles and not the external ones? You know, when I say that I came through three generations of like organizers, I really meant like, so I started out as one of my first jobs. I was a shop steward at like the first nonprofit that was unionized in the country, you know, and then I've been a consultant for organizations that are going through unionization and I've been in management, right? And so, you know, and I've been a member of organizations that are going through it. And I think this is a hard question, you know, if what it takes to support a new contract also means that we're not able to serve our members in the same way, that's a really big question to ask. And like all of us deserve to have fair employment standards. We all deserve that. And, you know, right now, I think, you know, if you're going to answer the question, if one side of the organization is pitted against another side, and you're going to answer that question really differently, it may be time to think about, is this an organizational pivot? And I'm not saying that the unionization is like right or wrong. What I'm saying is the resources that we have to win are limited, and how we're using them should be an organization-wide, not just staff, but like member-wide discussion about what's the primary issue right now and what needs to be resourced. And that's going to take a lot of humility and a lot of self-awareness and a lot of ability to negotiate with each other, disagree, debate, have heartbreak, you know, grieve what we had, and then face the new direction.
Raquel, you've led so many folks, including me, in strategic and somatic practices that can support strengthening the resilience of our relationships. Are there any practices you want to offer to people listening to this?
There are a lot of practices. and I think, you know, one theme in here has been, you know, our movement is going to really change. It's going to grow in a lot of ways and it's going to shrink in others. So I think the thing that to me just keeps coming up is like every one of us is going to have to make a commitment every day of if we want to be in this or not. And I'm going to share that, you know, in terms of like personal process, that before I went into my paid role at NDWA, I care took for my father, and he passed a few months before I started that position. And then my mother, I could care take for her, and she passed a few months after I left NDWA. And so for me, it was like 12 years of like grieving both of my parents and, you know, the loss of like leaving an organization, which felt like part of my heart and my blood and my, you know, oxygen. And, you know, in the period afterwards, it was really hard to tell if like stuff was being done to me or if I was just like so raw because of being in grief. And, you know, this overlapped with like post-pandemic organizing into now. And I, you know, since 2024, it's been, I've had to really move how I commit every day to being from, you know, going in a place of like intense grief and not sure about what my role was anymore, if I wasn't caretaking for an organization or a parent, to trying to figure out like who and what I was now. And I offer this because at some point, everything felt so raw and painful that it was just really hard to discern what was me, what was an organization, what was a movement, what was the larger conditions that we were in. And if I had been in an organization right now, I don't know that I would have been like a real useful participant. So what I did was like really convert like what, instead of the grief and loss, what were the qualities that each of like my parents, those people I loved and lost, NDWA embody, that I could embody so I could honor instead of grieve. And it was like courage and creativity and curiosity, connection, right? And so that became my commitment every day, like my thought to myself, I'm going to embody these things because those were the things that were taught to me. And that opened me up even more to this second iteration. Like, how do I take some of these practices that I've been working inside of organizations for so long, but also make them quicker because we need to be quicker in this moment. So I have the courage to take political risks. I also have the courage to like give and receive feedback very hard and very quickly and the courage to move on, even if I'm not entirely satisfied. I have the courage to be in relationship with people that I don't agree with because I want to organize in the millions. So it just was, I was able to shift how I was being in the world. And so that crucial thing about having like an important commitment that helps you be resilient enough to get through what is the fear that we're living in, the heartbreak of the world that we're in, but also the heartbreak we give each other. And then be really open and curious about the possibilities when millions are in our movement and be connected to the discomfort of that and the possibility of that. So just offer that as like, you know, there's a way in which like being so self-aware made me be able to discern like, I am not being hurt by somebody or this may hurt, but I do have control over how I enter into this movement. And I'm going to commit to how I am every day so that when I'm making decisions about who I am in relationship with, they're based on what we want to achieve in the world, as opposed to anyone's bad behavior or bad decision, including mine at any one moment.
Thank you so much for sharing about your grief and like how you channeled that grief. And like, yeah, first, just thank you for being honest and vulnerable and like actually modeling the practice that to be in resilient relationships with each other, it does take this level of honesty, this level of self-awareness, this level of redirecting, and that even you naming, like, it was my recommitment each day, an individual commitment, I could tell it didn't stop with you. It was like always in purpose of, in service of a greater, you know, a greater purpose. And it was for all of us. So, yeah, just thank you for that.
And I just want to notice all the qualities you just named that you we're feeling and figuring out how to honor are like qualities that we talk about in Red Ops, you know? So speaking of just ripple effects of your own personal transformation and commitment to this movement, right on. Thank you.
I'm really modeling that even though like I've been in this for a long time and I'm a leader, like you are at any one time learning again, You know, like my favorite thing as a leader is to be able to follow somebody else and also to know that like I've actually fallen down and I need to figure out how to get back up. It is not, you know, it is a constant process of committing to be a leader and learning how to be a better one every day.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for modeling how to be a leader with Tasha and I, and now to so many more listening to this. Thank you.
Yeah, we need to wrap up. I wish we could keep talking. This is such a juicy conversation. I'm so glad we took the time to extend this one.
Me too.
But we have a little speed round.
Okay.
Surprise. So Shaw and I are going to alternate asking you questions. And it's first thought, best thought. Whatever answer comes to you is the right answer. Most important, spreadsheets or post-it notes?
Both.
Breaking down the binaries already. Exactly.
For each their own purpose.
All right, you might have the same answer, but notes, digital or analog?
In your head. Use your brain. I mean, yeah, you have to. I mean, I don't have as much in my head as I used to. This old brain still says brain.
I love it. Okay, three options this time. Text versus phone call versus voice note.
Oh, text.
This one is a little contentious. Receipts. Do you keep them or toss them?
Shred them.
Yes, security.
No evidence. Just like having notes in your brain. You're shredding the thing. Cannot be used if it cannot be found.
I sense a theme here. Okay, give us a shout out to an org or an ops person you are loving right now.
Oh, an org, working families party. An ops person, Tiger Kegel Walsh at and Ratima Ook at Grassroots Power Project.
What song do you put on to set the tone for a meeting or a session?
Oh, I am never the DJ because my speaker will never work.
It's true. I can be a witness to that.
You cannot rely on me for any tech. Sorry.
True. What is the soundtrack for your operations work?
Okay, well, we're recording the day after the Super Bowl, so we are going to have to say Bad Bunny.
Yes. That's like my everything soundtrack right now. So. Mm-hmm.
Three words to describe the future of movement operations.
Wide, flexible, and firm. Did I just describe a diving board?
Yes, you did. I think you did.
At least I'm consistent.
Okay. I only need two words, diving board.
You know, consistency is trustworthy.
That's right.
And last one, one wish you have for movement operations people in this moment.
That you want to learn and you just be in the strategic purpose of what we're doing together and you own how much infrastructure is important to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much, Raquel, for saying yes, for being here with us at this closing of our season one and for all the work that you've been doing and that I know you're going to keep doing. I'm really honored to be in this work with you.
Same. Thank you for being here and so honored to keep walking this path with you.
Thank you for pushing me to do it and taking risks. Appreciate you both.
Yes. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can subscribe and listen to more episodes wherever you find podcasts. Check out the additional resources from each episode in the show notes and take it all back to dialogue with your teams about building adaptable and values-aligned infrastructure. You'll also find links there to subscribe to the RadOps Substack, where you'll get the latest updates and resources.
This show is produced by Josh Elstro and published by Convergence Magazine. Design support from Kimmy David. Music by Tiger Cat, my amazing 10-year-old, with Polish by Josh. And remember,
keep it rad, y'all.